Hey guys, welcome to the Bitcoin Fortress podcast, helping you increase your financial freedom. This is episode 106, recorded on March 10th, 2024. This podcast is for entertainment only, not investing advice. Do your own homework. Well, we got a lot to go over this week. Lots of interesting top Bitcoin news, a lot of stuff on adoption, actually, which is quite interesting. We'll start with the market update outlook, and then we'll finish featuring this week's blog post. And with that, let's get started. Wall Street finished lower after a choppy session on Friday as investors reacted to a mixed jobs report by booking some profits in the technology space, which has been the engine of the market gains so far this year. The U.S. economy added 275,000 jobs in February, topping analyst estimates of 190,000. At the same time, the unemployment rate moved up to 3.9% versus the expected 3.7% figure. For the week, the NASDAQ slipped 1.2%, while the Dow Jones and S&P 500 fell 0.9% and 0.3%, respectively. Looking ahead, the Consumer Price Index report for February will be closely watched next week. Economists expect headline CPI to rise 0.4% month over month for February and be up 0.3% once the food and energy categories are stripped out. Inflation is expected to show a 3.1% year-over-year increase for the month. Other economic reports that are due to be released include the Producer Price Index report, the Retail Sales report, and the latest reading from the University of Michigan on consumer sentiment. So that will be interesting. After adding it all up, investors may walk away with new interest rate expectations. Currently, Goldman Sachs thinks the first rate cuts from the Federal Reserve, European Central Bank, Bank of England, and Bank of Canada will be in June. However, there is less clarity around the forecast, with central bankers reluctant to provide guidance too far in advance. Sizing up the FOMC tea leaves, Seeking Alpha Investing Group leader Lawrence Fuller expects to see softer payroll data and a continuation of the disinflationary trend that would then allow the Federal Reserve to reduce rates sooner, with the economy on track for a soft landing. The earnings calendar for the week ahead is headlined by Oracle and consumer-facing companies such as Dollar Tree, Kohl's, and Dick's Sporting Goods. Meanwhile, the conference calendar is very active during the week, including the Deutsche Bank Media, Internet, and Telecom Conference and Barclays' 26th Annual Global Healthcare Conference. Investors will also have their eyes on the Starbucks Annual Meeting of Shareholders. In the healthcare sector, the FDA action date arrives for Madrigal Pharmaceuticals' Resmetirom, which has the potential to become the first and only medicine approved for NASH liver disease. Finally, the stock market could see some extra volatility at the very end of the week with Triple Witching Day on March 15th, featuring the simultaneous expiration of stock options, stock index futures, and stock index options contracts. Okay, moving into the Bitcoin top Bitcoin news of the week. First up is from Bitcoin.com. This is the Week in Review, highlighting some of the more significant stories. First one here, on March 1st, 2024, an infamous and vast Bitcoin mega whale moved 2,000 vintage Bitcoins from 2010. And now, 4 days later, on March 5th, the day Bitcoin hit its peak value of 69,210 per coin, the same entity transferred another 1,000 Bitcoins from 2010. So everybody's speculating on what that means. Next up, JP Morgan has cautioned investors that the price of Bitcoin could fall to 42,000 after the halving event in April. The global investment bank's analysts explained that 42,000 is the level they envisage Bitcoin prices drifting towards once Bitcoin halving induced euphoria subsides after April. The bank also recently stated that the Bitcoin halving and the next major Ethereum upgrade are, quote, largely priced in. Guess we'll get some cheap sats then. Bitcoin Cash, don't care about. Following Bitcoin's climb beyond the $65,000 mark, social media has been buzzing with discussions about the rumored acquisition of Bitcoin by a billionaire from Qatar, after the Bitcoin Atlantis conference in Madeira, which was just, I think it was last week, a sighting of a Qatari jet at the airport subsequent to the Bitcoin Atlantis gathering has caught the public's attention with the shared image amassing over 189,000 views. I guess there might be some truth to that. Who knows? Next up is from Z Crypto. This was posted on March 10th. And again, we're going to go through a few articles here focusing on Bitcoin adoption. This first one here, maybe I should buy some Bitcoin, asserts billionaire Bill Ackman as Bitcoin nears 70,000. Billionaire investor and CEO of Pershing Square Capital, Bill Ackman, has recently commented on Bitcoin's soaring price, suggesting that its meteoric rise could have significant implications for energy production, consumption, and the broader economy. In a Sunday tweet, Ackman presented a scenario in which the escalating value of Bitcoin could trigger a surge in energy consumption. He posited that this could subsequently lead to inflationary pressures and a depreciation of the US dollar. Bitcoin goes to infinity, energy prices skyrocket, and the economy collapses. Maybe I should buy some Bitcoin, said Ackman, adding later, the problem, of course, is that it also works in reverse. Ackman's tweet ignited a spirited discussion within the Bitcoin community. While some challenged the accuracy of his predictions, others concurred with his conclusion that investing in Bitcoin might be prudent. Michael Saylor, a staunch advocate for Bitcoin and the founder of Bitcoin development company MicroStrategy, suggested that Ackman consider purchasing Bitcoin for different reasons. You should buy some Bitcoin, but not for the above reasons. Most Bitcoin miners are driving the cost of electricity down for other consumers, not up, Saylor responded. Notably, and that's true, because Bitcoin is really monetizing stranded energy for the most part. And miners will shut down if there's, energy demand increases and so on and so forth. And of course, with the difficulty level continuing to go up, and then also the price of or the halving event cutting, in half what the miners are going to earn, there's probably some miners that are going to go out of business or go offline. So there's a lot going on in the game theory, so you can't just assume that everybody's going to plug in a miner as the Bitcoin price goes up post-halving. It's a little bit more complicated than that analysis that he offered. Notably, Ackman's optimism towards Bitcoin isn't novel. In November 2022, the businessman expressed positivity about cryptocurrencies despite setbacks like the collapse of FTX. I think crypto is here to stay, and with proper oversight and regulation, it has the potential to greatly benefit society and grow the global economy. All legitimate participants in the crypto ecosystem should therefore be highly incentivized to expose and eliminate fraudulent actors as they greatly increase the risk of regulatory intervention that will set back the positive potential impact of crypto for generations, Ackman had stated. At the time, Ackman disclosed being a minor investor in various crypto enterprises with investments constituting around 2% of his total assets. That said, the discourse surrounding Ackman's scenario underscores the ongoing debate concerning environmental ramifications of Bitcoin mining. That FUD just won't go away. While some argue that Bitcoin mining is environmentally unsustainable, others contend that it promotes the adoption of alternative energy sources, thus reducing overall energy costs. Meanwhile, Bitcoin's price continues to climb upward. The cryptocurrency has rebounded impressively after a robust start to March, with prices surging to as high as 70,083 on March 8th before experiencing a slight pullback. Bitcoin and Ethereum outperformed traditional equities this week, according to crypto analytics firm Santiment, The firm highlighted that the dropping exchange balances also indicate that investors are holding on to their Bitcoin rather than selling, a trend indicative of bullish sentiment in the market. Bitcoin was trading at 69,659 at press time, reflecting a 1.87% increase in the past 24 hours. And yeah, I don't really think Bill Ackman gets it, but, you know, everyone gets Bitcoin at the price they deserve. Next article is, this one's posted on March 9th. This was from ZCrypto. And article's entitled BlackRock's Global Allocation Fund Eyes Spot Bitcoin ETFs Expects Institutional Uptake to Drive Bitcoin Above $600,000. It was funny too. There was actually an interview that was going around on that was on CNBC with Larry Fink, and he was literally out there shilling Bitcoin, which was just kind of amazing, because you would, if somebody had said that 5 years ago, you would have been laughed at. BlackRock, one of the world's largest asset managers, Larry Fink, by the way, is the CEO, with over $9 trillion in assets under management, is positioning itself to capitalize on the growing interest in Bitcoin by filing to add spot Bitcoin ETFs to its global allocation fund, according to an SEC filing on March 7th. This move marks a significant development in the institutional adoption of Bitcoin as BlackRock seeks to invest in spot Bitcoin ETFs listed and traded on national exchanges, including its own iShares Bitcoin Trust and ETFs issued by other institutions. And this is a quote from the filing. The fund may acquire shares in ETPs that seek to reflect generally the performance of the price of Bitcoin by directly holding Bitcoin, Bitcoin ETPs, including shares of a Bitcoin ETP sponsored by an affiliate of BlackRock, BlackRock said in a statement. The decision to invest in spot Bitcoin ETFs comes as BlackRock's IBIT has seen a remarkable increase in Bitcoin holdings since its approval on January 11th, 2024. Hard to believe that was 2 months ago. The fund's Bitcoin holdings have surged from 2,621 on January 11th to 187,531 as of March 7th, representing a growth rate of over 7,000%. This substantial increase in Bitcoin holdings underscores BlackRock's bullish outlook on the digital asset. BlackRock's confidence in Bitcoin is further highlighted by its belief that the optimal allocation for Bitcoin in a portfolio should be approximately 84.9%, which is, wow. This view aligns with the growing sentiment among institutional investors that Bitcoin is a viable store of value and a hedge against inflation. The approval of a spot Bitcoin ETFs is expected to drive further institutional uptake of Bitcoin. Ernst & Young estimated that approximately $200 trillion of institutional asset managers were skeptical about Bitcoin until the spot ETFs were greenlighted. With more institutions entering the market, ARK Invest's Kathy Wood speculates that Bitcoin's price could surpass $600,000. The approval of spot Bitcoin ETFs could have a significant impact on the market, even with a conservative 0.5% allocation into Bitcoin by the 200 trillion institutional funds. Bitcoin could see a market cap increase of over $1 trillion. This influx of institutional capital could drive Bitcoin's price to new all-time highs. At the time of the writing, Bitcoin was trading at 68,220, showing a slight pullback from its recent record highs. However, with the growing institutional interest and the approval of spot Bitcoin ETFs, Bitcoin's price trajectory remains optimistic, with the potential to reach new all-time highs. So again, this is more adoption of Bitcoin, which is good. It's what we want to see. And I think more people are starting to realize that even though the ETFs aren't the best way to hold your Bitcoin, and they're certainly not the way it is intended to be held, it's really intended to be held in self-custody. The reality is that companies, institutions, and some high net worth individuals just don't want to deal with the hassle of having to manage your own keys, sadly and unfortunately. And so these are viable options. But of course, all the advertising and Larry Fink shilling Bitcoin on CNBC all really helps drive adoption and awareness and draws more people into Bitcoin, which is really probably the most beneficial effect. And then people begin to learn more about it and fall down the rabbit hole and so on and so forth. So not a bad thing to help drive adoption. Okay, continuing on this adoption theme, this article is from bitcoinnews.com, one of my favorite sources. This was posted on March 9th. Article's entitled Arizona Senate to add Bitcoin ETFs to retirement portfolio. The Arizona State Senate has approved a resolution to explore the inclusion of Bitcoin ETFs in the Arizona state pension. Very smart move. This resolution will prompt state pension fund managers and treasuries to assess the potential of incorporating Bitcoin ETFs. Senator Jake Hoffman is spearheading the initiative to promote Bitcoin adoption in Arizona, with state pension funds in the USA collectively managing over $5.5 trillion in assets, a significant portion of which are dealing with funding deficits. This action is perceived as a strategic move to bolster portfolio diversification and mitigate investment risks. Arizona considers using Bitcoin ETFs because of the belief that Bitcoin's value and stability is similar to how people trust gold as a safe investment. Arizona State pointed out three main angles that the Arizona State Retirement System and the Public Safety Personnel Retirement System bodies can check out the push for a Bitcoin ETF. Firstly, they suggested looking at how adding a Bitcoin ETF could affect their investment portfolio. Secondly, the Senate mentioned keeping a close eye on developments in the Bitcoin ETF world. They also mentioned that the ASRS and PRS could explore the implications of adding the Bitcoin ETF, possibly by consulting with an issuer approved by the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. If these steps are taken, they might then provide a detailed report on the feasibility, risks, and potential benefits of allocating some of the assets under management by the retirement systems to Bitcoin ETFs. Although this recommendation isn't mandatory yet, it's a clear sign of the widespread interest in these new investment vehicles. Investing in Bitcoin isn't necessarily risky. In fact, not purchasing a Bitcoin ETF could be seen as the riskier choice, especially considering the significant underfunding of many pension funds. Earlier this year, John Palmer, president of the Chicago Board Option Exchange, predicted that the approval of a spot Bitcoin ETF would open doors for pension and retirement investment accounts to access Bitcoin through ETFs. Many state pensions invest in gold ETFs to reduce risk in their portfolios. Adding a bit of gold has been shown to boost portfolio performance over the long haul, as gold tends to hold its value during economic turbulence. Bitcoin is often referred to as digital gold, and including it in a well-balanced portfolio could greatly reduce the chances of the portfolio losing its value during economic crises. Just like gold, Bitcoin is seen as a safe bet in times of financial uncertainty, like the ones we're living in now. Bitcoin has witnessed a consistent inflow of large liquidity since the ETFs got approved. Institutions are buying huge amounts of Bitcoin, approximately 9,000 Bitcoin every day, which is far more than miners are mining. This huge demand for the digital assets has propelled the price to $69,000. Bitcoin ETFs are less than 3 months old, but they have already surpassed silver ETFs in terms of assets under management, and they're on their way to dethrone gold. If the demand for Bitcoin continues at this rate, it's likely to surpass $100,000 within the next 2 years. So it doesn't sound like it's, mandatory or anything like that, but the fact that they're looking at it is good and bodes well. And even a small percentage allocation in a pension portfolio would help mitigate the risk of some of the other assets in there, particularly the bonds, which are, deemed to be the safest investment, with the currency debasement, and the interest rates still being relatively low, and inflation, real inflation, not the BS numbers that are reported, running high. It's harder and harder for pension funds to rely on fixed income to substantiate or to support the pension payments that they need to make. And of course, stocks are, hard because they're some are in a bubble, some aren't doing anything, and so having a little allocation to Bitcoin would be a very smart move, as I said earlier. So next article is also from Bitcoin.com or Bitcoinnews.com. This was posted today. More adoption thoughts. Bitwise CIO foresees big institutional move into Bitcoin ETFs in Q2. In a recent weekly memo to investors, Bitwise CIO Matt Haugen shared insights into the burgeoning interest from institutional investors in January-approved spot Bitcoin exchange-traded funds. All according to Haugen, I guess it's Haugen, institutions representing trillions of dollars in assets are expected to enter the Bitcoin market through these ETFs by the second quarter of the year. Haugen highlighted that the introduction of Bitcoin ETFs was initially perceived as a bridge for professional investors to enter the Bitcoin market. He noted that the past 7 weeks have emphatically confirmed this perception, showcasing widespread participation from various investor groups. Notably, since their introduction in the United States on January 11th, spot Bitcoin ETFs have experienced substantial success, amassing around $9.6 billion in net inflows. This remarkable growth has raised questions within the investment community regarding the driving forces behind it. According to Haugen's memo, Bitcoin ETFs have attracted interest from a diverse range of investors, including individual retail investors, hedge funds, and asset managers, registered investment advisors, family offices, and venture capital funds. Haugen disclosed that Bitwise, along with multiple Bitcoin ETF issuers, is actively engaged in serious due diligence discussions with major financial and corporate entities. He explains that these discussions involve a range of participants, stating, "Just as important as who is buying today is who will be buying tomorrow. At Bitwise, and I'd assume at other Bitcoin ETF issuers, we are having serious due diligence discussions with major wirehouses, institutional consultants, and large corporations. Although specific details about the identity of these entities remains undisclosed, Bitwise CIO expressed confidence that they would initiate the first significant flows into Bitcoin during the second quarter." Haugen expresses optimism by stating, "I think those flows will accelerate throughout the year as these investors become more comfortable with the new products." This optimistic projection is grounded in the growing comfort level that institutional players are developing with digital asset products. Institutions are recognizing the potential of these products to provide diversified investment opportunities, marking a significant shift in their attitude towards the Bitcoin market. Notably, leading RIA firm Carson Group, which handles $30 billion on its platform, recently selected four Bitcoin ETFs to be offered to its clients. In a recent report, JP Morgan acknowledged the noteworthy inflows into spot Bitcoin ETFs, forecasting a substantial growth of approximately $62 billion in inflows over the next 2 to 3 years. The basis for this projection lies in the comparison with gold as a benchmark and applying a similar volatility ratio to estimate the potential size of Bitcoin ETFs. The inclusivity of investors from different backgrounds indicates a notable shift in Bitcoin market trends as the market continues to evolve. The expected entry of major wirehouses, institutional consultants, and large corporations into Bitcoin through spot ETFs signals a promising trajectory for the digital assets integration into traditional investment portfolios. So, another voice of expected continued institutional adoption. This was kind of an interesting one from the Crypto Potato. This article was updated March 9th. Arcum Intelligence has revealed that Tesla currently possesses 11.51 thousand Bitcoin valued at $780 million distributed across 68 addresses, while SpaceX holds 8.29 thousand Bitcoin totaling $560 million spread across 28 wallets. These findings are substantiated by on-chain fund flows that align with financial disclosures from both companies. In a tweet on X platform, the blockchain analytics platform said that Tesla made a notable entry into the crypto market with a $1.5 billion Bitcoin purchase in January 2021, followed by two significant sales, $272 million in Q1 2021 and $936 million in Q2 2022. Arkham has identified the Bitcoin holdings of Tesla and SpaceX. We are the first to publicly identify these holdings on chain. Additionally, the EV maker briefly allowed Bitcoin transactions for purchasing vehicles between March 24th and May 12, 2021, as corroborated by its Tesla Intel exchange bounty, which unveiled a Tesla car acquisition linked to this extensive cluster of its holdings. Tesla initiated its engagement with Bitcoin by investing $1.5 billion back in February 2021, acquiring approximately 43,000 Bitcoin. Simultaneously, the company announced its acceptance of Bitcoin as a payment method. However, subsequent decisions resulted in a reversal of this policy, with Tesla reducing its holdings of the premier crypto asset. But they're sorry they did that. Tesla's public statements have not acknowledged any changes to its Bitcoin holdings. Even the most recent earnings report issued in January makes no mention of the cryptocurrency. In fact, its Q4 report showed that the car manufacturing giant held 9,720 bitcoins worth $387 million and refrained from buying or selling the asset throughout the quarter. Meanwhile, not much is known about SpaceX's Bitcoin holdings owing to its status as a privately held entity. Despite these, the Wall Street Journal report revealed that the spacecraft manufacturing firm altered its Bitcoin investments by $373 million between 2021 and 2022, including the divestiture of a certain portion of the asset. Next up, also for BitcoinNews.com, this was posted today. Articles entitled Alan Kohler, Bitcoin is a Disruptive Force and Paradigm Shift in Finance. Bitcoin, the world's first scarce digital asset, has been a subject of intense debate since its inception. Critics have often labeled it as a Ponzi scheme or a speculative bubble waiting to burst. However, Australian financial journalist Alan Kohler presents a different perspective in his latest article, referring to Bitcoin as an insurrection against the traditional financial system. Contrary to popular belief, Kohler argues that Bitcoin is not a Ponzi scheme or a bubble, but rather a disruptive force challenging the norms of free market financial capitalism. He acknowledges that when Bitcoin crashed by 75% in 2022, many believed it would plummet to zero. He stated, a lot of people felt vindicated, and many were inclined to predict, perhaps a bit too gleefully on reflection, that it would go to zero. However, it made a remarkable recovery, reaching record highs once again. Kohler asserts that Bitcoin will actually never go to zero, and the skeptics are doomed to be perpetually perplexed. Kohler's words resonate with a sense of optimism for the future of Bitcoin. He adds, Ponzi's and bubbles are a normal part of the system that allow regulators to tighten their largely ineffective control. But a security that regulates itself, that's an insurrection. So Bitcoin might look like a Ponzi bubble because its price is volatile and it seems to be in the grip of speculators and scam artists. But in fact, it may be the only thing that isn't one. One of the key features of Bitcoin highlighted by Kohler is its inherent security and tightly controlled issuance. He explains, Bitcoin is an inherently secure, tightly controlled asset with a regulated supply and is therefore a subversion to the whole basis of free market financial capitalism. Unlike traditional currencies subject to the whims of central banks, Bitcoin operates on a decentralized network governed by a set of predetermined rules. He also points to Bitcoin's unique halving mechanism, stating it plays a crucial role in its operation. Every 4 years, the reward for mining new Bitcoin is halved, leading to a gradual reduction in the rate of supply. Kohler emphasizes, a halving is where the computing power required to mine bitcoins yields half as many units as it did before. This scarcity is in stark contrast to the inflationary nature of fiat currencies. In recent months, the introduction of Bitcoin spot exchange traded funds has made it easier for traditional investors to gain exposure to the Bitcoin market. Kohler notes, inflows into the ETFs are running at more than $600 million per day. This influx of institutional capital reflects a growing acceptance of Bitcoin as a legitimate asset class. While the future of Bitcoin remains uncertain, its impact on society cannot be ignored. Kohler draws parallels to historical financial revolutions, stating, "As for where Bitcoin will end up and what its place in society will be, will it become a means of transaction, a store of wealth, or just a plaything for speculators? I have no idea." He likens the ongoing evolution of Bitcoin to the French Revolution, suggesting that its true impact may only be evident in hindsight. Balaji Srinivasan, former CTO of Coinbase, echoes Kohler's sentiments, describing Bitcoin as a political revolution. He predicts that nation-states failing to grasp its significance will attempt to seize control of it from citizens in the future. Alan Kohler's perspective on Bitcoin challenges conventional wisdom. Rather than dismissing it as a speculative bubble, he views it as a transformative force in finance. As Bitcoin continues to defy expectations and gain mainstream acceptance, its role in shaping the global economy will become increasingly apparent. In a world dominated by traditional financial institutions, Bitcoin represents a paradigm shift. Its decentralized nature, coupled with a regulated supply, challenges the status quo and offers a glimpse into a future where financial sovereignty lies in the hands of the individual. As Alan Kohler aptly puts it, many things might be Ponzi's or bubbles, but Bitcoin might be the only thing that isn't one. So really nice article, and couldn't agree with him more. And we certainly don't know what's going to happen in the future. Bitcoin does what Bitcoin does. So that's why you just stay humble and stack your sats. Next article is from BitcoinNews.com. I love this site. It's great. It's got really good content. This was posted today. And I thought this was kind of interesting. This is articles entitled "Bitcoin: A New Hope for the Forgotten Struggle in Myanmar or Burma." Myanmar, a little-known country with a population of 50 million, embodies the array of challenges and aspirations faced by oppressed citizens living under a brutal dictatorship. Therefore, the country and Myanmar currency present the Bitcoin world, which opposes tyranny and advocates for human rights, with a unique opportunity to demonstrate how Bitcoin can be a force for good in a turbulent world. Of course, I've written about this in my blog and have followed these types of things before, so I thought this was really interesting and really wanted to go through this with you all. On the unexpected morning of September 5th, 1978, Myanmar, also known as Burma, was stunned by dictator Ne Win's sudden declaration that the 75, 35, and 25 kyats notes would no longer be legal tender, instantly rendering 80% of the currency in circulation obsolete. This unforeseen announcement, which offered no chance for the conversion of these notes, unlike the 1985 demonetization, effectively wiped out the savings of millions of Burmese citizens overnight. The declassified CIA document referred to these actions as the no-win economic policies. At that time, Myanmar lacked connectivity infrastructure, so the news spread by word of mouth. In short order, thousands of students in the country's two largest cities, Rangoon, now Yangon, and Mandalay, marched in protest against Ne Win's sudden demonetization policy. These protests were rapidly quashed by Myanmar's brutal military regime, costing the lives of thousands of civilians. But due to Western sanctions and the junta's isolation policy, this story quickly faded from the global consciousness. The country of Myanmar, situated at the crossroads of India, China, and Thailand, is known for being a land of beauty and abundance. The country is dotted by thousands of ancient pagodas, virgin beaches, and untouched mountain landscapes. Due largely to Myanmar's abundant supply of natural resources, the country has been tortured by over 75 years of civil war. A series of bloody military coups, wide-scale human rights violations by the military, sometimes known as the Tatmadaw, and what is often described as the resource curse. In the early 20th century, Myanmar's largest city, Rangoon, rivaled New York City as the world's largest immigration port and the first America for many families from the Indian subcontinent. This backdrop set the stage for the historical trajectory of modern Myanmar, which has been marked by multiple crises. Before 2010, obtaining a mobile SIM card in Myanmar cost $2,000 in a country where the GDP per capita was only $1,000 at the time. According to Bloomberg, Myanmar had fewer internet users than North Korea during the same period. With the internet symbolizing information freedom, the military junta propagated the idea that the internet was primarily a source to consume pornography. This was an effort to deter young people who traditionally live under parents or older guardians from spending time in internet cafes. It was slightly successful in the Buddhist conservative country. In an era where information on the internet was heavily censored by the military junta, countless Myanmar users still remember the trepidation of sneaking out of their homes to reach their destination, the internet cafe. There, the Windows XP computer screen offered a gateway to the forbidden universe, and they utilized VPN programs to bypass restrictions. Their cyber journey in the air-conditioned room powered by an electric generator was not merely for entertainment. It was a hunger for knowledge, a desire for connection with the outside world, an opportunity to practice their English, and a chance to read international news not available in physical papers. Some shared their wonderful discoveries on the internet with their peers in the classroom who were not allowed to visit the internet cafe. Advanced internet users at the time also found their place in the global tapestry. Some websites completely omitted the country's name during the registration step, while others, scrolling through the options, hoped to see Myanmar listed among other nations. If not, they would press B to search for Burma. These inconsistencies in recognition became a poignant symbol of the forgotten nation's identity in the internet age. These minor inconveniences may seem small, but they were significant, forming collective memories for a generation and marking an early stage in claiming their identity and place in the 21st century world. In 2010, Myanmar emerged from the shadows of isolation towards a path of democratic reform, culminating in the release of Aung San Suu Kyi after nearly 15 years of house arrest. Her freedom represented a hopeful shift towards democracy and human rights in the country. This period of transformation generated international attention and optimism. The evolution of Myanmar's transformation was amplified by the historic visit of U.S. President Barack Obama in 2012. As the first sitting U.S. president to visit Myanmar was an impactful moment in relations and international recognition of Myanmar's steps towards reform. The dawn of Myanmar's transformation period crackled with vitality as the country opened its doors. Thousands of Myanmar from abroad felt the pull of their homeland returning to fuel its development. Urban streets buzzed with open debate, while the rebirth of private daily newspapers breathed fresh air into public discourse. Items once considered luxuries, such as M&M's chocolate candies, found their way onto store shelves alongside Coca-Cola, marking their return after the U.S. lifted its sanctions, marking the end of over 60 years of absence from the market. Big techs like Google, Microsoft, Visa, MasterCard, and global professional services firms like KPMG, Deloitte, EY, PwC, and numerous other global giants swiftly carved their niches in Asia's frontier market. To the outside eye, these might seem just like a regular market capturing in the capitalist machine, yet for those who had lived in isolation for decades, this influx was a tide of positive change that felt overwhelmingly significant. While the world largely lauded Myanmar's strides towards modernization, Myanmar's journey towards a brighter future quickly ran into a huge speed bump. The advancement of connected technologies threw a stark light on the Tatmadaw's ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya, a crisis fueled by Islamophobia and exacerbated by the spread of hate on Facebook and Meta's Messenger platform, which had become the country's default window to the internet and main communication channel. Amid the turmoil, Jack Dorsey, then CEO of Twitter and a prominent Bitcoin advocate, chose Myanmar as the site for a 10-day silent Vipassana meditation to celebrate his birthday. His silence on the military's atrocities and human rights abuses drew sharp criticism. Jack tweeted, acknowledging, "I'm aware of the human rights atrocities and suffering in Myanmar. I don't view visiting, practicing, or talking with the people as endorsement. I didn't intend to diminish by not raising the issue, but could have acknowledged that I don't know enough and I need to learn more." Myanmar's hopeful transformation seems to be taking one step forward and two steps back. Despite connectivity, technology, and open market developments, the 2021 Burmese military coup resulted in imprisonment of President Win Myint, State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi, and many of other elected civilian leaders once again in 2021. The military junta wielded the centralized internet, centralized mobile services, and centralized financial institutions like a hammer, crushing the people's uprising that wished for the taste of continued pushing forward, the glimpsed freedoms and progress. And this certainly shows you the risks that you run with centralized systems. Shortly after the coup, US President Joe Biden moved decisively by freezing $1 billion in assets belonging to Myanmar's government and unveiled a series of sanctions. At the end of his speech announcing these actions, President Biden said, "I'm sure I'll see some of you at the Pentagon," fueling hopes of US military intervention or support in the near future in the Myanmar community. However, such hopes were dashed as no military intervention or support occurred, leaving the Myanmar people feeling disheartened and without recourse. And probably the sanctions end up hurting the people more than it hurts the government, as usual. During the massive crackdown after the coup, the Tatmadaw ordered telecom operators to stop mobile data internet services, a strategy to minimize information flow among protesters. Bank accounts were frozen en masse, targeting anyone who had donated to activism efforts or was actively involved in the resistance. During this chaos and violent suppression, the international media largely ignored the nightly arrests of activists in Yangon and evidence that their dead bodies were returned to their families with clear signs of torture the next morning. If there's any silver lining to Myanmar's latest military coup, it's that the coup has galvanized the entire country to fight against the junta and find creative ways to provide material and financial support for Myanmar's spring revolution. This is what makes Bitcoin such a powerful force for good and for the fight against totalitarianism. Alex Gladstein, Chief Strategy Officer of the Human Rights Foundation, underscored the potential of Bitcoin in the struggle in his book, Check Your Financial Privilege, which vividly recounts his personal experience during the early days of the revolution. As a personal example, someone reached out to me at the beginning of the Myanmar Revolution in February 2021. They wanted to provide aid to the democracy movement, but the banking system was practically shuttered, and there was no easy way to wire dollars. After doing some digging, we were introduced to an aid worker turned activist who was also a Bitcoin user. He could easily accept a donation, save it in Bitcoin, and then sell it into the peer-to-peer markets when he needed to spend the collapsing local kyat on currency on goods. An address was sent over Signal, and a gift was made in minutes. No barriers, no middlemen, no possibility for corruption along the way. It is just one small example, but it is a glimpse of what the future could hold. Gladstein's experience demonstrates that Bitcoin can play a critical role in grassroots democratic revolutions, especially in places like Myanmar, where inflation has run rampant. Despite Myanmar people's resilience over the 3 years, the weakness of Myanmar's currency, the kyat, fails to reflect their courage. The kyat has plummeted by over 160% against the US dollar, with gold prices soaring by 190% in the same time frame. Faced with such dire circumstances, many are forced to choose between fighting against injustice or ensuring their survival. Given the junta's threats of legal action against unauthorized foreign currency dealers, gold remains the asset of choice for the vast majority, as real estate loans are underdeveloped and beyond the reach of average individuals living under the nation-state cage ruled by the oppressive military regime. Given this environment, Mekong I revealed that since the 2021 coup, at least 20 gold mining permits have been issued, some to companies linked to military personnel in regions home to ethnic minorities in Eastern Shan State. This increase in gold mining exacerbates the hardships for local communities, particularly affecting women, girls, and students who grapple with the consequences of mud, floods, and polluted waters from mining activities. Some villagers lost entire houses and were forced to flee their places because their land was no longer fertile. Not to mention the extreme environmental disaster caused by the military-linked gold mining companies. While Western mainstream media often criticizes Bitcoin technology and Bitcoin mining for its energy demand and environmental impact, without bipartisan data, they ignore the glaring issues in its blind spot: the destructive nature of gold mining on the ground, a limited system of choice creating more and more wealth inequality and exploitation of the minority group, especially in a country like Myanmar. The shadow of military rule extends far beyond Myanmar's remote areas, casting a pall over the entire country and extending to citizens living abroad. Western sanctions, though targeted at the military and its affiliated corporations and individuals, indiscriminately cause widespread hardship on both the freedom fighters and the general population. The military generals and their crony elite associates are supported by the other side of the international connections, getting out of the Western sanctions with relative ease. Simultaneously, the average Myanmar citizen finds themselves caught in an invisible fallout where the sanctions act like radiation, extremely harmful but seemingly invisible. For the country's best and brightest, living under the boots of the military regime is unbearable. Yet the pathways to a freer world are frustrating and slim chances of getting a visa. For example, in fiscal year 2022, the rejection rate for U.S. B visas for Myanmar nationals stood at 46.15%. To offer a broader perspective on the issue, it is a figure that aligns with the rates for citizens from El Salvador, South Sudan, and Sierra Leone. Similarly, the F1 student visa rejection rate was 34.91%, indicating that even if a U.S. institution has accepted a student who deserves an American education and could potentially contribute to the U.S. economy in the future, does not guarantee visa approval. In the past year, 2023, only 1,877 Myanmar students successfully obtained their visas. Passport privilege and financial privilege are two sides of the same coin. In an accelerated, faltering economy, freelance websites have emerged as a vital lifeline, offering a chance to earn harder currency and enhance professional skills for Myanmar people. However, platforms like Upwork, Turing, and Freelancer.com have recently withdrawn their services from Myanmar, citing Myanmar's inclusion under the Office of Foreign Assets Control sanctions. Similarly, TransferWise, a popular centralized money transfer service, announced, "Unfortunately, it's getting increasingly difficult for us to operate in Myanmar, so we'll need to suspend our service." The decision by foreign companies to exit Myanmar structurally disempowers and isolates the country's talented and ambitious citizens and only intensifies the challenges faced by Myanmar's younger generation. Sounds like they need a peer-to-peer solution. The frustration was vocalized by H. Tyke, a Bangkok-based Myanmar citizen and digital production professional, who said, "It's particularly tough for the young people." He then added, "Most people rely on online payment methods for their online projects, but now we're stuck because the online payment registration requires a Myanmar passport, and they're denying us the services simply for being Myanmar citizens." Through another voice message, he elaborated, "Rumors are circulating that many regional companies, whether in Singapore, Thailand, or Dubai, are hesitant to hire qualified Myanmar citizens due to these restrictions. It's disheartening to see the burden fall on the shoulders of young, talented people who did not commit any crime." To make matters worse, he said, "Even LinkedIn refuses Myanmar passports for account verification purposes. It's a sanction barrier impacting not just professional opportunities, but also our ability to connect globally." He regularly commutes between Yangon and Bangkok for his business. He uses his Thailand bank account for international transactions, and he saves some of his savings in cyberspace. Under such extraordinarily challenging circumstances, who could deny that the magic of internet money is a lifesaver for them? Like everywhere on Earth, not everyone is equally adept at navigating the cyberspace. During a conversation with Myanmar's parallel National Unity Government, Deputy Minister of Finance and Investment Min Ziyar Oh addressed this gap. Min Ziyar Oh said, "In the early days following the coup, we fled to the jungle to avoid political persecution. It quickly became clear that there are no banks in the jungle. That's where we realized the potential of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies," he shared, pausing thoughtfully before continuing. "While this technology offers potential solutions for our community living abroad, the reality on the ground is different. Many within our borders face a steep learning curve with this new technology." With Myanmar's digital literacy level relatively low, the deputy minister's observations are particularly relevant. MnZRO also highlighted another huge challenge. The most significant obstacle we face is the logistics of utilizing Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in areas like the Sagang region, where armed resistance is gaining ground. The question then becomes, how do we convert digital currency to cash in areas where the internet is a dream? His insights underscore a serious hurdle in utilizing digital currencies as a tool for empowerment in a complex sociopolitical landscape. I keep my savings in Bitcoin and stablecoin, declared Miat, a tech-savvy working-class engineer residing in Yangon who has dreams of one day leaving Myanmar. Just in case, if we should need to flee for safety, there's nothing we need to pack. We just leave. Miat's voice carried an unmistakable hopefulness about his potential departure, saying, "It's crucial for every Myanmar citizen to opt out of our current system and harness the maximum benefits from the alternatives." So what a great story. But it does show, one of the difficulties that they have is with internet connectivity. And but I think there are a lot of solutions being developed. As long as you have a mobile phone, you can you should be able to do quite a bit with Bitcoin. But then there's the education process, which is a bit of a challenge for sure, especially when you don't have a lot of tech savvy people because you lack the infrastructure. So anyway, fascinating story. And then we're going to finish up with an article on understanding your Bitcoin keys and what are BIP39 seed words. And this one's probably good to read, and like I'll include the links in the show notes to all the articles as usual, because it does show some things that I'm not going to totally read through, but I thought this would be good to go through. The bedrock of Bitcoin self-sovereignty is having control over your private keys. Without this, in one way or another, you are relinquishing control of your money to someone else. Not your keys, not your coins, as the saying goes. A counterintuitive aspect of Bitcoin for people who aren't familiar with the technical underpinnings of it is where your Bitcoin actually is. When people think of a wallet, they think of the place where I keep my money. Your Bitcoin wallet doesn't actually hold your Bitcoin, it just stores your private keys. Your Bitcoin is just entries of data on the blockchain hosted by everyone participating in the network. When you go to spend your Bitcoin, what you are actually doing is proposing an update to the data stored on the blockchain. A private key is how the protocol ensures that you and you alone can authorize an update to the blockchain that spends your Bitcoin. So, what are your private keys? Just very large numbers, extremely large. This is a private key in binary, and then there's like a paragraph with lots of ones and zeros. 256 random ones and zeros. This random number is what ultimately secures your Bitcoin. It might not look like much, but its randomness is what ensures your wallet's security. There are almost as many possible Bitcoin private keys as there are atoms in the visible universe. This is how many numbers a computer would have to count through to generate and catalog all the private keys potentially possible. As long as the process used to generate the keys is truly random, your keys are safe. This is what a private key looks like in hexadecimal. Binary uses two digits to encode a number, one and zero. Hexadecimal uses 16 digits, 0 through 9 and A through F, and then there's a very long number there, a combination of letters and numbers. This is what a private key looks like in uncompressed wallet import file or wallet import format. And then he's got another one. WIF format is how everyone used to interact with their private keys in the early days of Bitcoin. In this era, you could generate one private key at a time, and then you'd generate the public key from that. The process of generating a public key is essentially just the multiplication of the very large numbers, but there's a bit more to it than that. All public keys are an X and Y point on a graph showing a very, very large curve that loops back on itself. On the graph curve in Bitcoin's case, there is a point called the generator point. This generator point can be thought of as the base point on the curve. It is integral to the process of generating keys and signing with them. This is what the generator point is for Bitcoin's curve, and then there's a little formula below. To generate the public key from your private key, you take the private key you generated and multiply it by the generator point. That's it. This now establishes a point on the graph with a mathematical relationship to the private key you generated that only you know. This is an uncompressed public key showing both X and Y points, and then there's another paragraph of lots of numbers and letters. It is very common to compress public keys in the rare chance that you interact with them just to store the X coordinates with a byte to tell you whether the Y coordinate is negative or positive. That shortens it considerably. When you go to sign a transaction with your private key, it once again boils down to essentially just multiplication. By generating a random number, the nonce, and using that and your private key to essentially multiply the hash of the transaction you're signing, you produce the signature, which is made up of two values, R and S. This allows someone to run an algorithm to verify the message was signed by the appropriate private key without revealing that key. The thing guaranteeing only you can authorize spending your Bitcoin is essentially just the multiplication of very, very large numbers. If you aren't all that familiar with these concepts before reading this, all of this probably seems somewhat intimidating. Binary, hexadecimal, graph points, how do you back up a WIF? Since the development of more intuitive ways of handling this data, most users are unfamiliar with these complicated formats. Most likely, you have more experience with word seeds, also known as seed phrases. Mnemonic seeds or seed phrases were created to address the problem of the experience of interacting with your private keys. As we discussed earlier, private keys are ultimately just a long series of ones and zeros that are randomly generated. Imagine trying to create copies of this and ensure you didn't make an error transcribing it. All it would take is a single error copying one digit to render a backup of your keys useless. This is where mnemonic seeds come in handy. 256 consecutive ones and zeros in a row is not a human-friendly way to interact with sensitive information. Recording this number incorrectly means losing access to your account. Truck, renew, fury, donkey, remind, laptop, reform, detail, split, grief, because, fat. It's a list of words there. That is much easier to deal with, isn't it? Just 12 words. So how does that work, going from a bunch of random ones and zeros to a string of words that actually make sense to you? An encoding scheme just like binary or hexadecimal. Each of those 12 words in that mnemonic seed above is a binary number in an encoding scheme mapping specific strings of ones and zeros to words. If we look back at the WIF private key example earlier, it was simply a number encoded in a specific encoding scheme. In that case, base 58, which uses every number and letter of the alphabet except 0 and 1, and O and I, case sensitive. The exclusion of those characters was done specifically to make transcription errors unlikely by confusing a 1 for a I or a O for a 0, or a 0 for an O. BEC32 and BEC32M, used by SegWit and Taproot, take this to the next level by using only this set of characters, and then there's the list of that. Bitcoin Improvement Protocol 39, sorry, Proposal 39, BIP 39, introduced a standardized encoding scheme where each word in a specially crafted dictionary is alphabetically mapped to a binary number from 00000000001 to 111111. The demonstration seed above maps to this, and then they kind of go through each of the words and what the numbers are associated with those words. And then in just binary, it looks like all those numbers just listed together after each other. There are 2,048 words, each mapped to a specific 11-digit string of ones and zeros, specifically to make it easier for people to interact with their private keys. When you generate a random number for your private key, your wallet cuts that number up into chunks of 11-digit binary numbers and maps them to the BIP39 mnemonic dictionary. It's still the same large number, but now you can read it as English words. Since your brain is much more accustomed to this format than long strings of ones and zeros, This drastically reduces the odds of you writing down something wrong and losing your Bitcoin in the process. You may have noticed that in the raw binary encoding of the word seed above, there are four digits, 1011, sitting off on their own, and the last word is only actually eight digits. That is a checksum to ensure that the seed phrase is valid. When you generate your random number, there aren't enough digits to map it exactly to 12 or 24 words. The wallet hashes those existing digits you generated and takes the first few digits of the hash to add on to the end of your random number. This gives you enough digits to map to the last word. This last word allows you to perform a safety check on copies of your seed. If you enter your mnemonic seed into a wallet incorrectly, the checksum will not match. Each 12 or 24 word seed has multiple potential valid checksum words, but if the last word doesn't match the checksum of a correct seed, your wallet will warn you it is invalid. This gives people an intuitive yet still mathematical way to guarantee their backups are correct, unlike the messy process of transcribing and backing up the raw binary numbers. The selection of the specific words on the list even went so far as to guarantee that none of the 2048 words have the same first four letters. This was done to reduce the likelihood of people making transcription errors by confusing similar words and winding up with an incorrect backup of their private keys. Translating these words into a set of multiple private public keys is quite simple. Your mnemonic seed is taken and hashed using SHA-512, which outputs a hash of 512 individual ones and zeros. Half of that output is used as an actual private key, and the other half is used as an input to SHA-512 with an index number and the existing private or public key to generate a new key pair. You can do this as many times as you want to generate new private public keys that can all be recovered from your single mnemonic phrase. This ensures that you can manage your private keys as easily and safely as possible with the lowest odds of making a mistake that loses your money. And all of it was done using math. Hopefully you have a good understanding of why people say that Bitcoin is money secured by math. So I thought that was a very educational article. And again, if you want to read it, it's probably better to read it because you can see what they're actually talking about visually. Again, there's going to be a link in the show notes. And then I just want to conclude by mentioning this week's Bitcoin Fortress Substack post. Check it out. I'll include a link in the show notes. It is entitled "The Evolution of Fiat Currencies, A Historical Analysis. Can Bitcoin Break the Fiat Cycle?" So check that out and please subscribe. It's free. And I usually post a couple articles a week, usually one on Wednesday and one on Saturday. And with that, thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please like and leave a comment. Also, don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. You can also follow my Substack again at bitcoinfortress.substack.com. And you can follow me on Nostr. My NPub is included in the show notes. And also mention you should listen to Fountain. You can earn sats just for listening. I listen to all my podcasts on Fountain, so I really enjoy it. And with that, I will talk to y'all next week. Bye-bye.